Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the Pioneer Museum as we have our first in our Saturday, May lecture series. Today, we're going to look at George Herendy, who rode with Custer at the Little Bighorn, survived the battle. And what makes George Herendy kind of interesting is the fact he was from Bozeman. And let me back up and say my name is John Russell. I'm the director of the Gallatin Historical Society. We are the 501c3 that operates the Pioneer Museum of Bozeman. Now, next week, we will be looking at the Civilian Conservation Corps in Gallatin Canyon, and then that'll be followed the week after by a discussion on the 1959 earthquake at Hebgen Lake. And the Saturday, May lecture series, we decided to do these in the month of May, do them on Saturday, and hence the name, Saturday, May lecture series. But anyway, today's topic, George Herendy. He was a native of Ohio, and Herendy was 29 years old when the battle occurred. He had lived in Montana for barely 7 years. But he garnered enough experience in the wilderness to win appointment as a civilian scout in the Sioux War of 1876 and to be a surviving participant in the most publicized American military battle ever fought. More has been written about the Battle of the Little Bighorn than any other military engagement in American history. My wife and I were down in West Yellowstone a couple of years ago in one of the bookstores, and there was an entire section devoted to Custer. And there was an elderly couple in there. The lady was looking at all these books, and then she said to her husband, "Look at all these books on George Custer." And the old guy kind of squinted and looked over all the titles and says, "Yeah, that's a lot of eulogies for an A.H." Well, as I mentioned, Herendy was a native of Ohio. He served in the Union Army for the last 6 months of the Civil War as a prison guard. And after the war, he traveled to Colorado and then on to New Mexico. From there, he helped drive a herd of Texas cattle to the Gallatin Valley and spent the winter of 1869-1870 tending the cattle near the Missouri headwaters. Now, some have thought that perhaps he was on Nelson Story's cattle drive, but we don't think so. Story's cattle drive having been back in 1866. Anyway, after his time up near the Missouri headwaters, he came to Bozeman, and in a poorly spelled letter to his sister Jenny Crampton in April of 1872, Herendy claimed he was living the high life in the Gallatin Valley, earning $60 a month as a common laborer. He spoke also of occasional raids by Sioux Indians, then roaming through the Yellowstone Valley, and that he and other settlers planned to retaliate and give them a game come summer. You have to remember that at this particular period of time, with the closure of the Bozeman Trail forts, there were a lot of Sioux and Cheyenne war parties that did roam through the Yellowstone Valley. That was technically Crow land, but after the closure of the Bozeman Trail forts, the Sioux and Cheyenne were living in basically what was an unceded territory to the immediate east of the Crows. If you were here in the valley back in those days, for the most part, you were pretty safe. There were some raids into the Gallatin Valley, nothing serious. But if you should venture over the Bozeman Pass into the Yellowstone Valley back then, you were taking your life into your hands. And ever since John Bozeman brought his wagon train into the valley, the settlement that bore his name was plagued by a strong sense of isolation, and that was caused mainly by the tenacity of the Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho. Now, these warring tribes had forced the government, as I mentioned, to close the trail back in 1868, making travel and the shipment of goods to and from Bozeman very, very costly. As a matter of fact, in this era, before the railroad arrived, if you wanted to ship something east or you wanted to travel east, invariably you would have to take a wagon road from here down to Corinne, Utah, where the railroad head was. You could get on the train there and then travel, and it was very, very costly. Now, though concentrated in that unceded territory of the Bighorn Basin, bands of Indians continued to roam through the Yellowstone Valley, fighting the Crows. The people of Bozeman felt this community could not survive without free and open travel through the Yellowstone Valley, and the pressure exerted on the government to open that territory for the railroad indirectly resulted in clashes between whites and Indians, culminating in 1876 at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. George Herendeen was a participant in many of these clashes. During the summer of 1872, he was employed as a carpenter at the Crow Reservation on Mission Creek. On July 30th, he and a few other workers were hired as scouts for the U.S. Army and its escort of an engineering survey party seeking a route for the Northern Pacific through the Yellowstone Valley. Led by Major Eugene Baker from Fort Ellis, this escort had 8 companies. On August 14th, while camped opposite the mouth of Prior Creek, the survey party and its escort were attacked by Sioux and Arapahoes intent on stealing the expedition's horse herd. After a 6-hour fight, the Indians retreated. The Army kept the horse herd intact, but 1 sergeant and 1 civilian were killed. 3 privates were wounded, and Herendeen here received his first taste of Indian warfare at the site that became known as Baker's Battleground. So the example of Baker's Battle serves to show how difficult it was to try to get anything accomplished in the Yellowstone Valley. There were several fights through the Yellowstone Valley with Sioux and Cheyenne, and the so-called Baker's Battleground was one of them. After that battle, Herendeen split his time between Bozeman and his reservation job until February of 1874, when he joined more than 100 others on the Yellowstone Wagon Road and Prospecting Expedition. That expedition was started here in Bozeman. It was financed by several of the prominent citizens of Bozeman, including Nelson Story. On the surface, the idea behind this expedition was to go down the Yellowstone River and to look for gold. Their real intention was to pick fights with the hostile Indians in the hopes that the United States government would intervene. The area where they were going into would be, part of it would be the Wolf Mountains, Rosebud Creek. They would cross and recross the Little Bighorn River. When word of the expedition reached the U.S. Army via Fort Ellis, some Army officers thought this is not good. No good can come from this. They had their own policy as to how and when the Yellowstone Valley would be opened. There was an officer stationed at Fort Abraham Lincoln who thought this expedition out of Bozeman would precipitate no good. It would just rile up Indians even worse and take longer to basically, eventually, open the Yellowstone Valley. That officer at Fort Abraham Lincoln was Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. And he was just a couple of years away from visiting the same area. And we all, well, we'll save the best for last, I guess. So their hope was to establish a wagon road to the mouth of the Tongue River. From there, produce and other goods from Bozeman could be loaded on steamships and then transported east. Backers of the expedition, like I said, Nelson Story, they hoped that it would trigger the warfare. Each of the men were armed with a breech-loading rifle, and the expedition had 40,000 rounds of ammunition. They had 2 artillery pieces capable of firing mackerel cans loaded. One of them was capable of firing mackerel cans loaded with shrapnel manufactured by Walter Cooper. That's it right there, the Bighorn gun. And over in the display case that we had to move out of the way, you can see a map of the expedition, and in there is a mackerel can You can imagine a mackerel can stuffed in that, stuffed with shrapnel, and then shot off, you know, with gunpowder packed in there. It was a giant shotgun. It would be extremely lethal. By the time they reached the mouth of the Bighorn River, the expedition had grown to 150 members. In mid-March, this force crossed to the south side of the Yellowstone River near present-day Forsyth, and then proceeded toward Rosebud Creek. The area was dry and desolate, and Sioux war parties were spotted on several different occasions. On April 1st, after they made camp, George Herendeen and four others went on a short scouting mission. Herendeen broke away from the others to track a deer. Instead, he found fresh pony tracks near a small grove of pines. Looking ahead, he saw the other four at the base of a small rise, and then looking up on the summit was a lone warrior on horseback. Herendeen pulled up his rifle, began shooting at the Indian, and at the same time he yelled to his friends to watch for an ambush. The other four retreated. They all returned safely to the main camp, firing on a band of pursuing Indians throughout the retreat. And then 3 days later, while they were camped in the valley of the Rosebud, they came under fire from Sioux snipers hidden in a coulee. These Indians were turned back when a party of 25, led by Eli Way, attacked the coulee, killing 7 Sioux. One of the white attackers suffered a minor wound. A week later, the expedition, having swung west along the flank of the Wolf Mountains, went into camp on a hill above the South Fork of Reno Creek. On the morning of April 12th, the Sioux attempted to steal the expedition's horse herd. After an intense fight at close range in which an expedition member was killed, the Sioux again backed off. The men proceeded west, crossed the Little Bighorn River, and then pitched camp near present-day Lodgegrass. Following a 2-day snowstorm, gee, imagine that, snow in Montana in the spring, they got tired and disillusioned, and they decided to go back to Bozeman. On the 18th, while crossing the Lodgegrass Valley, the Sioux attacked once again. The Indians, reinforced by a Cheyenne war party, forced the expedition members to circle their wagons. After a lengthy firefight that including shelling from the Bighorn gun, Exhibit A, the Indians again retreated. This was the third and final fight. They resumed their trek back to Bozeman. By the time they reached home, they had traveled about 600 miles, but failed to find any gold or to establish a wagon road, much less get the army to intervene and open up the Yellowstone Valley. And these guys got back to Bozeman. They may not have been the type you would want your daughter to bring home for Sunday dinner. When they got back to Bozeman, they were given a parade down Main Street. And one of the things these guys did would wave the ears of dead Indians. They cut off their ears as proof of their trophies in the Yellowstone Valley. Well, in the spring of 1875, George Herendeen was one of several from Bozeman who established Fort Pease. It was another effort at trying to get something going in the Yellowstone Valley. This was a trading post opposite the mouth of the Bighorn River. The group's leader, F.D. Pease, he hoped the army would soon build a military fort nearby, but again, this didn't happen. In June, after helping to build the crude stockade, Herendeen joined Pease and they floated by boat down the Yellowstone to Fort Buford. There, Pease traveled to Washington to try and garner support for his enterprise. One of the first lobbyists from Bozeman, huh? But that didn't happen. Herendeen, he took a steamship back up the Missouri to Fort Benton, then wagon road to Helena. From Helena, he caught a stagecoach to Bozeman. Then he went right back to the Yellowstone River, traveling down the river to the site of the Baker Battle, where he had been in a fight just earlier. And here he built a dugout, lived alone, and spent the winter trapping wolves. Well, he went on to Fort Pease, and he left Fort Pease at just about the right time, for during most of 1875, that site, Fort Pease, was under siege by the Sioux. The beleaguered occupants, they appealed for troops, And this was answered early in 1876 when a relief force was sent from Fort Ellis. Now, while en route, the commander, James Brisbane, visited with Herendeen. Herendeen had gone back to his dugout. And Herendeen told Brisbane he could take care of himself and he wasn't afraid of the Indians, already having had numerous brushes with the hostiles that winter. Brisbane remained firm. Herendeen would have to leave for his own safety. And he was quoted, Herendeen was later as saying, "I was loaded up and taken to Fort Pease. I objected to being moved as I was doing no harm, but Brisbane persuaded me to go." The guy was either fearless or crazy, or a little bit of both. Okay? So this relief force reached Fort Pease, and the 19 remaining occupants there were forcibly evacuated, and they came back to Bozeman along with Herendeen. Now, beginning the previous year, many Sioux Indians, disgusted with the corruption and ill treatment at their agencies, had fled to the Powder River country. And with some of the conditions at the agencies, you couldn't blame them. The government dispatched couriers warning those who did not return to the reservation by January 31st of 1876 that they would be subject to government action. Few heeded the warning, and as a result, the Army mobilized. There was a lot of pressure on U.S. Grant at the time. His administration was kind of caving in because of all the scandals, a lot of them revolving around Indian agencies and corruption there. General Phil Sheridan, commander of the Military Division of the Missouri, he came up with a plan he thought would force these Indians back to the reservation. Three-pronged attack aimed at the Bighorn Powder River country. General George Crook would lead an army of 900 men north from Fort Fetterman, Wyoming. From Fort Abraham Lincoln in North Dakota would come the Dakota Column under the command of General Alfred Terry, and among his roughly 1,000-man contingent were 700 members of the 7th Cavalry under the command of Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. Third component of the force was the Montana Column, commanded by Colonel John Gibbon, consisted of 450 infantry and cavalrymen from Fort Shaw and Fort Ellis, as well as about 50 Indian and white scouts. Just a quick thing here, you know, Custer is known as General Custer. That was a brevet rank he achieved in the Civil War. After the Civil War, his rank returned to Lieutenant Colonel. But all of his men and his close friends, until the day he died, always called him General. The other interesting aspect here were the Clymer hearings in Washington, D.C. that occurred in the spring. Hester Clymer of Ohio, a Democratic representative, was out to make some political hay against the Republicans and U.S. Grant by holding hearings on corruption at the Indian agencies. Things haven't changed much in Washington, you know. And so he subpoenaed a lot of witnesses to testify about what was going on at some of these areas. And one of those he subpoenaed was George Custer. Custer sent a letter back to Washington saying, "Well, I'd just as soon stay with my post. Can I be excused?" And the congressman wrote back, "No." So Custer had to go back to Washington, D.C. Custer testifies in late March at these hearings. And he talks about some of the shenanigans at the agencies and how the Indians were being cheated and why the Indians were hungry. And he talked about illegal whiskey coming into the agencies. And he also implicated General Grant's brother in a bribe scheme to obtain agency posts. After he's done testifying, Custer, as a courtesy, goes to see his former commander, U.S. Grant, who's now the president. Grant won't see him. Grant's madder than hell at what Custer had to say about his brother. Custer spends several hours waiting to see Grant. Grant won't see him. Custer says, "Okay, fine, I'm going back to Fort Abraham Lincoln." So he gets on a train and he goes back to Fort Abraham Lincoln. He gets to Chicago. When he gets off the train, he's arrested. He's arrested for leaving Washington without orders and having failed to visit with his commanding officer. So Grant, as punishment, this campaign's coming up, General Grant says, "Okay, the 7th can go. Custer, you stay at the fort." Custer writes back and he pleads with him. He asks him, "Look, I ask that I have the right to go with my regiment, especially if they're going to be put into danger. General Terry intervened. Grant backed off and let Custer go under two conditions. You obey the orders of General Terry, and Custer, no newspaper reporters. Custer rarely obeyed a thing that General Terry said. And what was the first person Custer hired before he left Abraham Lincoln? A newspaper reporter. That gives you a little bit of insight into Custer. Well, anyway, back here in Bozeman at Fort Pease, George Herendeen was offered a job as a teamster with the Montana Column. He rejected the offer, claiming the pay of $16 a month was too low. He wanted to be a scout. The Montana Column began departing Fort Ellis in late March, heading east to rendezvous with the Dakota Column. On May 2nd, Herendeen and Paul McCormick departed Benson's Landing in a Mackinac boat named Fleetfoot. 4 days later, they caught up with the Montana Column and then camped near Fort Pease. General Gibbon hired McCormick as a sutler, then had Herendeen repair several small boats used the previous year by the Pease expedition. Gibbon thought they could be useful to the Montana Column, and on May 23rd, while the Montana Column continued its trek east, a small hunting party of soldiers was attacked by the Sioux. Herendeen was hunting alone nearby when he heard firing in the distant hills. He raced back to camp to spread the warning. Three companies of cavalry were dispatched to investigate, and just a few miles from the camp, they found two dead soldiers and one dead teamster, but no Indians. Herendeen's action got him the job he wanted. Gibbon appointed him as scout for two companies of cavalry under Captain Edward Ball. Herendeen helped lead Ball and two companies on a scout up the Bighorn River to the ruins of Fort C.F. Smith, and then a return to the Yellowstone River via Tulloch Creek. In all, they covered about 180 miles, but they saw no signs of Indians. The Sioux and Cheyenne were further east, closer to the Tongue and Powder Rivers. So as the Montana Column approached the mouth of the Powder River, Herendeen and a small contingent that included Major Brisbane and Lieutenant Gustavus Doan floated down the Yellowstone in one of the Mackinac boats to the mouth of the Powder. Here they found the steamship Far West that had traveled up the Missouri and Yellowstone Rivers as part of General Terry's advance. Herendeen and the two officers went on board, and soon after Terry arrived on the south bank, escorted by two companies of the 7th Cavalry. Terry agreed to pay Herendeen $300 to take a dispatch back to Gibbon, ordering him to come forward and meet Terry on the steamship. Herendeen accepted, reaching Gibbon at about 3 a.m. the morning of June 9th, and then as ordered, Gibbon came forward, conferred with Terry. Afterward, Gibbon moved the Montana Column to the south, to the mouth of Rosebud Creek, while Terry sent Major Marcus Reno and six companies of the 7th on a scout south of the Yellowstone. Reno returned on June 18th, informing Terry of a large, fresh Indian trail that headed toward the Little Bighorn River. Unbeknownst to all along the Yellowstone, the Indians who made that trail had just defeated General Crook and his force on the upper end of Rosebud Creek, and that forced Crook's withdrawal. Terry ordered the Dakota Column to advance to the Rosebud, and then on the evening of June 21st, he held a conference with Gibbon, Brisbane, and Custer on the Far West. As discussed at the meeting and finalized the following morning, Custer was to lead his 7th Cavalry up Rosebud Creek, while the balance of the command under Gibbon and Terry would cross the Yellowstone and then march up the Bighorn. It was hoped the two contingents would trap the hostiles in the valley of the Little Bighorn on the 26th. As part of the realignment, Herendeen was assigned to Custer. His orders to bring dispatches to Terry after Custer's force scouted the upper part of Tulloch Creek, and for his service, Herendeen was to be paid $200. So, well, anyway, Custer begins his march up the Rosebud on the 22nd, and 2 days later, the 7th passed the headwaters of Tulloch Creek. But there had been no sign of Indians. There was only a limited scout of the area. But Herendeen, who got along pretty good with Custer, rode his horse up next to him, and he said, "General, this is Tulloch Creek. Here's where I am to leave you and go down it to the other command." Custer just looked at him. Didn't say a word. Herendeen rode alongside Custer for several minutes, but he finally realized he wasn't going to be dispatched. So he fell back into formation. Custer had been given enough discretion by Terry, and he had, to push on ahead and engage the Indians if he felt justified. And his action toward Herendeen underlined his desire for the 7th to garner all the laurels. Later in the day, Herendeen again discussed Tulloch Creek with Custer. Both agreed that since the Indians were in their front, such a scout was unnecessary. Custer then made camp near present-day Busby, but learning that his scouts found fresh Indian signs, he ordered his men to break camp and ride on to the divide between Rosebud Creek and the Little Bighorn. Here the men went into camp. Herendeen recalled that at daylight the scouts informed Custer they had spotted the village from a hill on top of the divide known as the Crow's Nest. Herendeen later said that we moved up the creek until near its head and concealed ourselves in a ravine. It was about 3 miles from the head of the creek where we then were to the top of the divide where the Indian scout said the village could be seen. After hiding his command, Custer, with a few orderlies, galloped forward to look at the Indian camp. Custer returned about an hour later, says he couldn't see the Indian village, but the scouts and a half-breed guide, Mitch Boyer, said they could see it from about 15 miles off. It's interesting, Mitch Boyer, he was half-Sioux. He hung around Bozeman quite a bit. He worked for Leander Black over at the Crow Agency, and he was employed occasionally by Nelson Story, and he was Custer's chief scout that day. Now, while Custer was looking for the Indian village, the scouts came in and reported that he had been discovered, and that news was then on its way to the village that he was coming. Another scout said that 2 Sioux war parties had stolen up and seen the command, and on looking in a ravine nearby, sure enough, fresh pony tracks were found. Custer had officers' call blown, gave his orders, and the command was put into fighting order. Keep in mind, the idea of Terry's plan was that they were to meet in the Little Bighorn Valley on the 26th, maybe the 27th. Custer had marched a full day, made camp. He finds out signs of the Indians have been found, has the men march almost the equivalent of another day. They get to sleep for maybe 3 or 4 hours on top of the divide, and then he tells them they're going into battle. They're out of gas. So are the horses, okay? He divided his force of about 650 men and scouts into 4 groups. Custer would lead 209 men. Captain Frederick Benteen would take 114 men into the bluffs and hills to the left with orders to pitch into any hostiles he might encounter. Benteen couldn't stand Custer. Here's a guy that's in the 7th Cavalry. They never really got along that well. He thought Custer was something of a blowhard, and he thought when Custer was sending him off on what is known as this left oblique on the divide, Benteen thought Custer was pushing him out of the way so Custer could go down and get all the glory. So Benteen is kind of in a slow burn with Custer at this point. And again, the two never really got along. Major Reno, leading 175 men, would accompany Custer down the divide into the Little Bighorn Valley. And then bringing up the rear was the pack train, or under the command of Captain McDougall, about 135 men. Well, Custer and Reno then led their respective groups out of the Wolf Mountains, each on opposite sides of a creek, and descended into the valley, where they found a lone, deserted teepee on a small hill. 2 years later, Herendeen described this approach. "From the top of the hill, we looked ahead down the Little Bighorn, saw a heavy cloud of dust and some stock apparently running. We could see beyond the stream a few Indians on the hills riding very fast, seemingly running away. I said, the Indians are running, and we would have to hurry up, or we would not catch them." Custer was near at hand, was riding at a trot. The scouts charged down on the abandoned lodge, cut it open, and they found a dead Indian there. Custer now ordered Reno and his regiment to cross the Little Bighorn and attack the village, promising the major that he would be supported by the whole outfit. Custer and his force rode north along the east side of the river to their fate with destiny. You can see that here on this map. Again, Custer divides his men. He already sent Benteen out chasing rainbows. Now he gets down here. They're approaching the village. Custer's giving an order to an attack a village he doesn't even think exists. He doesn't know what's in there. So Reno and his men come out this way, and they head towards the Indian village. Custer and his men coming that way. One thing before I forget, as we kind of get into the fight here, with all the books, and again, I'm not an authority on the battle, but all the books, everything written on it, for the most part, talks about all the things Custer did wrong. Talks about the fatigue of the men. Talks about the rivalries of the officers. Reno couldn't get along with Benteen. Benteen wasn't wild about Reno. I don't think Benteen got along with anybody. They both really didn't like Custer at all. People get into all the things that went wrong, that Custer did wrong, that Reno didn't do, that Benteen didn't do that day. But the American Indians did a lot of things right. And you could argue, and there might be some Custer buffs who would disagree, but you could argue, even if Custer had had a more cohesive unit, he was still in big trouble because of the leadership of Two Moon and Crazy Horse and Gall and some of the Sioux warriors that were down in the valley. Right after the battle, there were theories published that somehow, some way, Sitting Bull must have been able to attend classes at West Point. I'm not kidding. And that the majority of the people with the Indians had to be white guys who were married to Indian gals, so-called squaw men. They couldn't accept the fact that a bunch of Native Americans could clobber the boy general from the Civil War. So, yeah, Custer did a lot of things wrong, and he had some help along the way from some of his officers, but the American Indians did do a lot of things right, as was testified later on by Herendeen at the Reno Court of Inquiry. He said there that he heard Custer tell Reno to lead out and he would be with him. Those are about the words I understood him to use. That is all I heard. And he said it was about a mile and a half from the village and about three-quarters of a mile from the river. He said that as he went down with Reno, Reno's group went into a slow lope, and Reno said, "Keep your horses well in hand, boys." And he says, "We took a slow lope so as not to wind our horses. We were about 5 or 6 minutes going in." And then he says that the command went through the timber and went on down the valley in a lope. He says, Herendeen, that he kept off to the left. And he says that as we advanced down the valley, fires commenced springing up from the timber that came out on the prairie. Major Reno's command came up facing that, and there were a few shots were fired into the timber by the soldiers. He says, "I suppose to draw the fire of any Indians that might be there." The command halted there and formed a skirmish line. This is one of the first controversies that surrounds Reno. Why did he stop and form a skirmish line? Why didn't he go on as ordered and attack the village? Reno and his supporters later said that the Indians were coming out to meet them and that they were a huge force. Herendeen and some others seemed to suggest that was not the case. Okay. Then Herendeen, at his testimony a couple of years later, says that I heard Reno order the troops to dismount, and there was a volley fired by the Indians. There was an Indian standing on Major Reno's front, not more than 8 or 10 feet from him. This, I should back up a little bit and make a couple of notes. When they halted on that skirmish line, warriors led by Chief Gall rode forward to meet Reno. Eventually, they did force the command to retreat to the timber that lined the river. Then, Herendeen says he rode up within about 6 feet of Major Reno once they retreated back to the timber, okay? So his objective, his order to hit the village, gone. Not going to happen. A lot of debate on whether he was justified in stopping, forming that skirmish line. Then he retreated to the woods, and then things just got worse. Again, Herendeen says that he heard the order for the troops to dismount, and there was a volley fired by the Indians. Now, the Indian that was standing no more than 8 or 10 feet from Major Reno was Custer's scout, Bloody Knife, who Custer had sent with Reno. And Bloody Knife is hit by fire from the Indians. And it appears this is when Reno really became unnerved because Major Reno is splattered with his blood and brains. He was so close to him. Reno then gave another order to dismount. The soldiers had just struck the ground. Everybody's down, per the orders. And then he tells everybody to mount. And then, according to Herendeen, everyone left the timber on a run. Herendeen is coming across as one of those saying that the retreat from the woods, Reno Woods, this is where he retreats to the woods, and then he leads this retreat back around across the Little Bighorn River up these bluffs to Reno Hill. But the controversy over his retreat is this. No bugle was sounded, as is usual military protocol if you're going to retreat. A variety of witnesses gave different accounts of what happened. Herendeen seemed to support the supposition that Reno became totally unnerved, panicked, ordered his men to follow him. One guy supposedly heard Reno says, if you want to save your lives, follow me. But when he did this, and he led these men out of the woods, and on this full-blown retreat, he left about 17 men in the woods. A couple of them were wounded. You just don't do that. There were a lot of men who never got the order, claimed they never heard the order to retreat. And then what's worse, and what Herendeen went on to testify about, was they could hear firing down the river as Custer, they think as Custer swung in, and all those Indians who had come out to meet Reno and forced him to retreat, once Reno's across the bluff and up back up on the bluffs, they turned their forces. They go to Medicine Tail Coulee, and that's where they meet up with Custer. A lot of the suggestions by some people was if Reno had held his position in the timber, and Herendeen was one of those who thought that he could have, maybe there would not have been as large a force that went on to meet Custer. Reno, or Herendeen, rather, at his testimony, he stopped short of calling Reno a coward. But he later expressed his opinion that the well-armed command, as I said, could have held that timber. Herendeen also believed Reno's retreat indeed freed the Indians to turn, join Crazy Horse, Two Moons, and other leaders, and then concentrate their attack on Custer. As a matter of fact, at the time, prior to the retreat, a small number of men had been killed on the skirmish line or in the timber. I think they lost like 19 men or more because it was like a turkey shoot when they were retreating and some Indians chasing them, just opening fire on them. And a lot of men were killed during the so-called retreat. There's another unverified story that when Reno got to the top of the bluff, and he was the first one there as commander, when he got to the top of that bluff, he was asked why he retreated. And he said, that wasn't a retreat. That was a cavalry charge. Anyway, Herendeen was later asked to describe what occurred after Reno split. He says, he started and got to the edge of the timber. Some of the men were passing me. All were going as fast as spurs would make an American horse go. And I started my horse. There was a dense cloud of dust, and I could not see where I was going. I got about 150 yards. My horse went down. I don't know if he stumbled or was hit. He was hit when I found him after. But he went down. I went back into the timber. Everybody was running for their lives. Some Indians like to have run over me as I fell. Probably 20 Indians almost ran over me. I got up, turned, and went right back into the timber. Herondine could see the futility of trying to get across Little Bighorn and climb those bluffs like Reno had done. And then he says, back in the timber, a few men dismounted, and some were mounted. I advised them to go into the timber and try and stand the Indians off. They turned back into the timber, and we stayed there. By this time, there were no Indians left in the timber. Some of them had chased Reno up the bluff. Others had turned to go to Medicine Tail Coulee to meet Custer. Herondine and the stranded troopers cleaned their guns, gathered their ammunition. They heard many volleys fired downstream and were sure that they were coming from the men under Custer's command. That firing lasted for about an hour. About an hour after the firing stopped, Herondine and 11 enlisted men, two of whom were wounded, came out of the woods, crossed Little Bighorn, and joined Reno's command on top of the bluffs, overlooking the river. By now, Reno had been joined by Benteen and the pack train. The Indians, having defeated Custer, now turned, came back after these remaining soldiers, and from their entrenched position, the balance of the 7th Cavalry then held them off until dark. Something about Benteen and his left oblique. He came back from his oblique after Custer and Reno were far ahead of him. He came back from that oblique, he and his men, and then followed the same trail down at a very comfortable lope. And he stopped at a watering hole, a morass, to allow his horses a drink. Allow his horses to be watered, which is a good thing to do. But he stayed there 20 to 25 minutes. And a lot of the officers with him were kind of scratching their heads, saying, it sounds like there's some kind of engagement further down the valley, Captain. The horses have had their water. What are we doing? He wasn't in any kind of hurry whatsoever. Eventually, Benteen and his men rode into the valley, followed for a while the same trail as Custer, and the first of two couriers came back from Custer, advising him to hurry, to bring the pack train. They're going to need the ammunition packs. And then yet another courier came, the infamous come, be quick, big village, bring packs, P.S., bring packs. And that original message is in a museum at West Point today. Benteen didn't really follow those orders. Instead, he rendezvoused with Reno, who was really, really badly shaken up. They merged their forces there. He would later testify that it was more important to him to get that group stabilized and organized in the face of a huge foe than it was to try and go forward any further. And that's where Benteen got into a lot of trouble with the so-called Custer buffs, those who supported Custer all along, saying that if Benteen had obeyed those orders and moved straight to Custer, it might have been different. Others say the battle for Custer was pretty much already over, and it's a moot point. So you can see how Reno and Benteen were blamed, came under harsh criticism from many in the U.S. Army and many of Custer's supporters, including Custer's biggest supporter, his widow, Elizabeth. Because Reno first stopped his attack and formed a skirmish line, and then retreated to the woods, and then, in totally disorganized manner, retreated across the bluffs, freeing the Indians to go help attack Custer. And Benteen, who joins with Reno, and they form an encampment up on top of the hill. And if you've ever been down to the battlefield, maybe you've seen that area where they were entrenched for a couple of days. Benteen gets under criticism for not moving in a forthright manner in order to help Custer. Remember, Benteen is still madder than hell, because Custer sent him off chasing rainbows. He wasn't in a big hurry. He spent 20 minutes at the watering hole. Exactly what happened there? Again, I get back to one very important point. There's a lot of things that the American Indians did right. They were well organized. They stayed focused, and they fought as a group rather than individual type of warfare. But anyway, we all know what happened to Custer and his group. Reno and Benteen, entrenched on the hill, survive. Finally, General Terry gets there on the 27th. Keep in mind, the idea was everybody to converge on the Valley of the Little Bighorn, hopefully on the 26th. Custer is a day early. Terry is a day late. He gets there on the 27th. And a lot of the officers from Fort Ellis here in Bozeman were those who came upon the scene and found what was left of Custer's command, some 200-plus officers, enlisted men, and civilians dead, stripped of all their clothing, some of them mutilated to an extent where they could not be recognized. The only way Tom Custer, George Custer's brother, could be recognized was because of a tattoo he had on his arm. That's the only way they knew it was Tom Custer. Well, Herendeen is one of those who stays with the Reno-Benteen entrenchment, and he survives the battle. The following summer, Herendeen accompanied one of the details sent to the Little Bighorn in 1877 to rebury the dead there. And according to Herendeen, when they removed Custer's remains so he could be buried at West Point, he said all that was left of Custer was about two handfuls of bones. Because after these guys were buried in very, very shallow graves, okay, the coyotes and the wolves took care of most of the rest. In 1878, responding to criticism of Custer's actions, Herendeen started to write letters from his home here in Bozeman to the New York Herald, hoping to correct misinformation he had said had been given to the public on the Custer fight. Some of the subheadings published by the Herald were critical of Reno, who had already been roundly criticized by military officers and author Frederick Whitaker, whose book, Life of General Custer, laid blame for the defeat squarely on his shoulders. Whitaker and his allies refused to accept one simple truth, and that's the fact that the Indians won the battle because they outfought and outmaneuvered the army. But Custer supporters saw the defeat as due to ineptness by Custer's commanders, specifically Reno and Benteen. Reno for his retreat from the woods, Benteen for not responding to Custer's aid. Whitaker demanded a congressional investigation. Reno, meanwhile, wanted vindication, and he wrote to the president demanding a hearing to refute all these charges. The request was approved. Military Court of Inquiry received orders to convene January 13, 1879 in Chicago. Now, a lot of studies of the Reno Court of Inquiry have been made. Evidently, there was a meeting with a lot of cigars and whiskey in Reno's hotel room by him and several other officers who were involved in the battle ahead of time to help get their story straight. There was one officer who claimed he was with Reno the entire time in the valley. He was with Reno. He never left his side, but there was a lot of testimony in subsequent interviews that proved this guy was wrong, was not telling the truth, was lying. There seemed to be a lot of evidence of a cover-up to protect Reno. And the Army, according to some, and this is why so many books have been written on the subject, okay, because no two Custer buffs are going to agree completely on what happened at the battle. When we open this up for discussion, I'm sure you're going to hear a lot of different views on what happened. But the Army didn't want a black eye. The Army, in its recruiting effort, didn't want to ruin or hurt that recruiting effort by showing disarray, potential cowardice within the Army. So there was a lot of testimony given. Even Benteen later on said that he didn't tell everything he knew because he was very careful to only answer directly what was asked of him. And he almost laughed about it later. So, anyhow, most of the Custer supporters, once again, I'm a broken record on this, but most of them do lay the blame at the feet of Reno and Benteen and kind of ignore, you know, how well organized and how strong the Indians were that day. Estimates range 6,000 to 7,000 people in the Indian village, a half-mile-wide village, a mile and a half long. Okay, this is a pretty good-sized little town, and you're talking 3,000-4,000 warriors, and Custer's total strength somewhere in the ballpark of about 600, give or take a little bit. Between the retreat from Reno's woods to what happened to Custer, and those who died of their wounds later, 265 men were killed at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, including Custer and all of those with him. Indian losses probably in the neighborhood of about 100. 3 weeks of testimony in Chicago. It's gone over, it's gone over. Herendeen is one of those who testifies. Herendeen goes through, and he's very thorough. One of the things he was asked was, were you afraid when you were in the timber? He says, no. He says, we were in a pretty good position. We had plenty of ammunition. And he was also asked by the recorder, who in effect was the prosecutor of Reno, did the men have sufficient ammunition with them when they were in the woods? And he said, yeah. And he felt that the men could have stayed in the woods, held off the Indians, and eased a lot of the pressure that eventually was put on George Custer. Herendeen, again, came across as one of those who seemed to suggest that it was really the fault of Major Marcus Reno. Well, anyway, after his testimony, he came back, and I should say something that was uncovered, well, not uncovered, but shown to me just yesterday by one of our volunteers, M. Mark Miller, who I'm going to talk some more about here in a minute, shows that Herendeen was also kind of involved in the Nez Perce struggle in 1877. He was here in Bozeman, and he and another man went over to Virginia City, Mark, Henry's Lake. Okay, they were asked by Gibbon to go help ascertain the strength of the Nez Perce. And again, this was in 1877, and they were able to telegraph information back out of Virginia City. And then they headed back to Bozeman, where on the way they came across an army troop that was heading for the Nez Perce. These guys wanted both of them to come scout with them, and they said, no. You can imagine Herendeen, I've had enough Indian scouting for a while. I'm not going to do that. But so he was, to an extent, involved with the Nez Perce uprising of 1877. But for the most part, for the next couple of years, George Herendeen, he spent time working as a common laborer and a saloon keeper in Bozeman, and he also guided sightseeing parties in Yellowstone Park. He never married. He was a lifelong bachelor, and he was one of those who pretty much kept to himself. About 1890, he went to work as a carpenter and a caretaker at Fort Belknap and then found employment at Fort Assiniboine. In 1914, Herendeen was elected a complimentary member of the Montana Pioneers here in Bozeman. And in 1916, he attended the 40th anniversary of the Little Bighorn Battle. In 1917, Herendeen showed Montana State College Extension agent Milburn Wilson and Custer historian Walter Camp important points on and near the Little Bighorn battlefield. Artifacts they reportedly uncovered ended up in the possession of Camp's widow. And then Herendeen spent his final years in Harlem, where in addition to carpentry and clerking in a coal and feed store, he served as a justice of the peace, police judge, and an election judge. On June 10, 1919, he fell ill, was taken to the Sacred Heart Hospital in Havre, and he died there a week later. Cost of his funeral was defrayed by the many friends that he had garnered in Harlem, and he was buried in that town's cemetery. So here's a guy who had a lot of experiences in the Yellowstone Valley, fighting Indians as a scout, as an Indian fighter, kind of played a minor role with another man and helping to ascertain the strength of the Nez Perce in 1877 as Chief Joseph led them towards Yellowstone Park. Based on his experiences in the Yellowstone, how it is he wanted to stay in his dugout along the Yellowstone and wanted to ignore the Army's order to get out of there for your own safety, it goes back to what I said earlier. George Herendeen was either fearless or crazy. And here's a guy with all this chaos in the Valley of the Little Bighorn with Reno, as everything is falling apart. Reno is running for his life, and some men are running to keep up with him, many of them who would die during that retreat. He was one with a very, very cool head, unafraid, realizing that he and the small group that remained in the woods and would wait until a better time to get out of there, that they had enough ammunition, they had good cover, and they could take care of themselves. So, and another aspect, too, about Herendeen in his involvement, when they were on the divide, he slept for a couple of hours before they came down the divide into the Little Bighorn Valley. He was asked at the Reno Court of Inquiry if he was tired, and he says, no, I got 2-3 hours worth of sleep. He says, I didn't have time for any coffee, but I got 2 or 3 hours worth of sleep. So, no, I was okay. I was all right. So, again, as to his mental capacity, we can leave that up to all of you folks. But that's basically the story of George Herendeen. You know, Mark has uncovered some information about him. And by the way, I don't want to forget, with Mark, one of our volunteers who has been published this Wednesday, May 9th, 3 p.m., Aspen Point, Mark, is going to talk about the summer of 1877 and the Nez Perce in Yellowstone. And you'll probably be mentioning Mr. Bean and Mr. Herendeen in your discussion there. So that's why I didn't want to get too much into it. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about it. So, see, that's called a tease in the broadcasting lingo. So hopefully, if you folks have the time, again, Mark will be talking about the summer of 1877, the Nez Perce in Yellowstone, Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, May 9th, 3 p.m., up at Aspen Point. So well, we can open it up to discussion, because I'd certainly like to hear your thoughts. There might be some aspects of the battle, or there might be some aspects of George Herendeen. This is what he looked like, by the way. That's Herendeen there. Not exactly Clark Gable, but what the hell. But we can get into some aspects of him. Like I say, we'll just kind of open it up to discussion. I know we have one guy here who's been on a couple of archaeological digs on the Little Bighorn battlefield, and that would be Dave Thorne. And I'm sure we have our share of Custer buffs out there. You know, Custer's battle song, the Gary Owen, it was an Irish drinking song. You know, I don't know. I'm half Irish. It doesn't bother me in the least. But why is every Irish song a drinking song? I mean, I guess that was just our nature, you know. But anyway, Gary, these Custer buffs, real serious students of this battle. They have meetings down at the battlefield every year. There's some of them, when they sign their letters, instead of saying, you know, truly yours or sincerely yours, they'll sign it Gary Owen. These guys are serious about it. Before we open things up for discussion, now here comes the, now a word from our sponsor. The Gallatin Historical Society is the 501c3 that operates the Pioneer Museum. We have programs like this. We have some satellite programs, i.e. what Mark is doing. We've sponsored some slideshows at various retirement homes showing how this valley looked 50, 60 years ago. And there's other off-site things that we do in addition to running the museum. Members to the society, you get into the museum for free. 10% off anything in the bookstore. It's tax deductible to the extent allowed by law, since we are a 501c3. And you get our quarterly publication, appropriately named the Pioneer Museum Quarterly. And it is a 40-page magazine that has a lot of articles on local history. One on George Herendeen appeared a couple of years ago in the spring 2010 issue. If you're not a member, we'd certainly be grateful if you'd give it some consideration and consider joining the society. The $5 that you paid to get in today can be applied towards that membership, okay? So just think of it. If you want to buy a $5,000 a year membership, hey, $4,995, come on, you can't beat that, right? And for all of you guys out there, I've got to mention, this has got to be the clincher. Our latest quarterly magazine is our swimsuit issue. Hey, if it worked for Hefner and Sports Illustrated, you got to do what you got to do, huh? Of course, these are swimsuits you would see in the 1920s, but there's an article here on the Bozeman Trail, John Coulter, and Mabel Cruikshank, the first woman to represent Gallatin County up in Helena, elected to the legislature back in the 1930s. So we cover an array of subjects, but we need your support to keep doing this. We have repairs and things we've got to do to the building. We just finished a program whereby we digitized 18,000 historical photos from this area. And we need to build and rebuild our catalogs of items that have been donated throughout the years. And so your support is really paramount to doing that. If you're already a member, thank you. Donations are always appreciated. If you're not a member, visit us in the bookstore, and if you could, please get signed up. Does anybody have any questions or? Yeah, Bar.
First thing, Daddy Boy is not a drinking song.
Oh, okay, there's one.
The other thing is, I was wondering about the person through Fort Benton coming down here. You mentioned that in Utah was the closest point, but Fort Benton, they freighted through.
Yeah, you could do that. You could, but the Missouri River, as far as, yeah, freighting goods up, that's true. But as far as expense is concerned and time, if that boat hit a sandbar on the Missouri River, it was used. Yeah, it definitely was used. But if you wanted to get your goods to the railroad in the quickest amount of time, then you would take the wagon road down to Corinne, Utah. But, yeah, that's a good point. The Missouri River route was your, there was a real strong effort here. Grant Marsh, who was the pilot of the Far West steamship in, what was it, 1875, he managed to bring the Far West all the way up to present day. No, it wasn't the Far West, my mistake. It was a different boat named the Josephine, a steamship. He brought it up to present day Billings. Josephine Park in Billings, that's where he got to. And when the word reached here that that boat got all the way past Pompey's Pillar, hey, we can build a wagon road from Bozeman down to Pompey's Pillar, and from there steamships can come up and go back down with goods, and we'll have a wagon road, and Nelson Story put a bunch of money into it, and Achilles Lammy put a bunch of money into it. But Grant Marsh was adamant in saying you could only do this in years of high water. The Missouri was much more reliable. And Lammy especially lost a lot of money. He kept trying to come up the Yellowstone on a consistent basis and finally wrecked his ship on the Wolf Rapids, not far from present-day Miles City. So that's another example of the obsession of getting the Yellowstone Valley open that people in early Bozeman had. And General Terry and some of the other officers involved in the Sioux campaign of 1876, history tells us that a lot of it had to do with the Black Hills and the government's violation of the Black Hills, the sacred area to the Sioux. And that's true. That had something to do with it. But a lot of these officers felt strongly the opening of the Yellowstone Valley had more to do with the Sioux campaign. And who were the biggest clamorers to open the Yellowstone Valley? Leander Black, Achilles Lammy, Nelson Story, and a bunch of others who lived here. There is a direct tie between Bozeman and the Western settlements and that campaign and what happened to Custer. There is a direct tie there. And within about a year or two after the Battle of Little Bighorn, that put the whole, the army really stepped up its efforts, and, you know, then you had Miles City established, and eventually Billings was established. So, you know, what was going on in our part of the state back then had a lot to do with it. It's interesting, one other thing, too. I mentioned Elizabeth Custer. A lot of the detractors, like Benteen and Reno, those people who couldn't stand Custer, and they had some allies. She had allies, too. She had very good connections with the U.S. Army and the government. General Nelson Miles was one of her best friends. And she was going to see to it through the Army and through official channels that the myth of Custer as a hero would be perpetuated. She thought he was. And so a lot of these other officers who were not fans of Custer decided to keep their mouths shut and not to explain why they thought Custer had it coming and what happened to Custer. And they were going to do it very simply. We'll wait until Elizabeth Custer is dead. Elizabeth Custer lived until 1932. She buried them all. She was in her upper 80s, early 90s when she finally passed away. So some think that aspect is one of the reasons that Custer went on to become an American hero. It's only recently with reexamining the battle and looking more from the Native American side, you get a kind of a different aspect to it. Battle strength of the entire 7th U.S. Cavalry on that day was 597. Now, that includes everybody. The pack train that was way in the back, Custer, Reno, Benteen's group, when you add them all up. Of that number, 265 killed or wounded. For Reno and Benteen, we do have a breakdown here. Scaling back, da-da-da. Fatalities under Reno. I should have maybe... Two men were killed on the skirmish line, and then in the timber, they did lose another 9 men. But when they ran to the river, Reno comes unglued, and he's leading these men to the river, some of them trying to get on their horses, some running on foot. 16 men were killed just between the timber and the river. Going up the bluffs, another 13 were killed. 29 killed in that retreat. Altogether, he lost a grand total of 40. Of course, with Custer's group, the total number with him, 210, including himself. And let's see, the field detachment strengths. You know, in answer to your question, JP, I thought I had that on the chart. Let's see, battle strength. Oh, here we go. Reno, of his men, 135. Survive. So he had just under 200 men going down that valley. Nobody with Custer survived, although there were a couple of lucky ones. Their horses gave out, and they ended up walking back and were able to rejoin Reno and Benteen. Let's see. And then on the hilltop, battle strength, Benteen's battalion, there were 115 survivors. They lost more men during the siege at the Reno-Benteen site over the next couple of days. Indian snipers were shooting at them, and then they had a real problem. The wounded, it's an extremely hot days down there, and the wounded clamoring for water. And they got volunteer soldiers to run down the bluffs under Indian fire to get to the river to fill canteens and come back up. Several men were given the Congressional Medal of Honor for that. And I may have to double-check this, but I think more men received the Congressional Medal of Honor in that battle than any other single engagement in American military history. Because several of them got for doing that. I think, is that date?
The reason for that is the Congressional Medal of Honor was the only medal for valor at that time.
Oh, okay. So in those days, if you were going to be awarded a medal, it was either the Congressional Medal of Honor or nothing. They didn't have any subchapters, huh? Okay, that makes sense. Dave is one of those who has been to the battlefield on some of the archaeological surveys. He helps us with our gun collection. Pretty good authority, very good authority, I guess I'll say, on antique weapons. Yes, sir.
When, how, and why did we lose Fort Smith? And would it have made a major league difference in terms of the history?
Fort C.F. Smith?
Yep.
I don't know if I... Do you know when... I don't. He's wondering when Fort C.F. Smith... That's right, yeah. Fort C.F. Smith, that's right, part of the Bozeman Trail forts. Red Clouds War, 1867, 1868. A lot of people killed along the Bozeman Trail. Gets to be known as the Bloody Bozeman. And, yeah, Fort Smith and those others are closed, which infuriated the people here in Bozeman. boy, they were really isolated now. No Bozeman Trail, you know. So they were really upset about that. The Crows rode with Custer not so much out of love for Custer or the U.S. Cavalry. They wanted the Sioux and Cheyenne off their land. Where the Sioux and Cheyenne were camped, technically, that was Crow land by treaty, technically. They were hunting grounds. I can throw out a couple of titles. I'd be curious to hear what Dave and some of the others say. There's one by Graham. Edgar Stewart, Custer's Luck. It's one of the early ones. That's still pretty good. Just about anything from Robert Utley, would you say, Dave? Cavalier and Buckskin is one of them. Custer in 76.
From the Indian point of view, I don't remember the author, but it was the Battle of Greasy Grass.
Yes, that's what they called the Little Bighorn Valley. Son of the Morning Star. I would say, Son of the Morning. If it was me, I would say Son of the Morning Star. I would say Custer's Luck. Custer in 76, because there's more extensive interviews with Herendeen in that. Yeah, I think a lot of those. One, and then, boy, you can really get immersed if like you read Walter Camp's notes on the Custer fight. She wrote a lot of books, Boots and Saddles, following the guide on, Elizabeth Custer did. Now, Elizabeth Custer ain't going to say anything bad about Audie. George Armstrong, he went by the nickname of Audie, kind of a play on his middle name. Now, she's not going to say anything bad about him. But there is a ton of material out there. But I think, like I said, the one Mark pointed out, some of the ones Dave mentioned, Custer's Luck. Sitting Bull was, I think, at the time, he was out on the other side of the village up in the hills meditating or something. He didn't fight. He was the leader. But the real battle leaders that day were Crazy Horse, Two Moon, Gall. But Sitting Bull really didn't participate in the battle, per se. I don't think there was any Indian testimony taken at the Reno Court of Inquiry in Chicago. However, there were many, many interviews done with Indian participants after the battle. One of the things after the battle, immediately after, a lot of the Indian participants were very careful what they would say. They were kind of afraid of any repercussions. And so some people, they would speak real glowingly. I'm glad you asked that, because they would speak real good about Custer. But a lot of them called Reno a coward. There were some who thought it could have been a totally different story if he had gone ahead and attacked the village rather than form a skirmish line. But then again, there are those who says that if Reno went into the village, that would have been pure suicide. We'll never know. But many of the Indian, those who were interviewed, pretty much told the interviewers what they wanted to hear. And that helped to perpetuate the Custer myth. It was only later that more things came out. Black Elk Speaks is a pretty good book. He was a young Sioux warrior at the time. But in an open court of law, no. But there was a lot of Indian testimony. You know, if we were to list every book written on that so-and-so, it's like the guy down in West Yellowstone said, that's a lot of eulogies for an AH. I was going to mention also with Reno, after the Court of Inquiry, and at the Court of Inquiry, basically he was exonerated, which infuriated the pro-Custer people because they saw it as a whitewash, hiding of all the facts. One of those killed with Custer was a young lieutenant, James Sturgis, or was it William? It was James. James Sturgis. And his father was a commander with the 7th Cavalry. Reno ends up assigned to him. And Reno really is, after that battle, he was really hitting the bottle for the next couple of years. And then, to top it all off, he gets arrested for being a Peeping Tom. That was at the fort down by Abercrombie. Okay, that's where he was stationed. And of course, Sturgis's father would not be a big fan of Major Reno, but Reno just kind of continued to come unglued. And yeah, he was eventually kicked out of the army. Drunkenness and, like I say, being a peeping Tom, and then he died about 1889 of throat cancer. So, yeah, George.
John, this may be overly simplistic, but if everything had gone well, if troops from Fort Ellis arrived, if Reno had done his job, would it have become any different given the numerical superiority of the Indians? Would this have been a wasted, much more bloody set of battles that would have resulted in what? Has anyone speculated about the other way of looking at it?
There's a lot of people who've made a lot of money speculating with all those books. That's a good question. I don't know. Some of the Indians felt that if Reno had hit the village, it would have caused enough panic, because the first thing an Indian warrior, an Indian brave would do, would want to see to his wife and children. If Reno had hit the village, they might have, maybe they would have been more interested in defending themselves by getting their village the heck out of there. Then again, if Reno had gone into the village, it might have been mass suicide for him. I don't know. And what do you think, Dave?
When Indians left the valley, went south on the 26th.
Mm-hmm.
They battled. And I think that was by and large because they knew that the Montana column and were coming up the Bighorn Valley, and they weren't going to stick around and take them. So, most Native Americans would leave a battle if they figured the odds weren't in their favor.
Mm-hmm. Maybe if everything had gone according to plan, if they'd all hit the valley on the 26th, could have been. But back to your original thing, George, we'll just never know. We really won't know. There are some, you know, who hate Reno. Several years ago, his body was reinterred, and he was buried at the military cemetery at the Little Bighorn Battlefield. The Custer Buffs raised hell. Oh, they came unglued. They didn't want him buried there, but he is.
Wasn't a part of the battle, but said to the warriors, now there's war. They want war, we'll give them war.
I don't know. Sitting Bull, as the Indians were coming days before down the Rosebud and camping in various places, he did have a Sundance. And during the Sundance, where he had like 100 strips of skin cut off from him, bleeding, and he has a vision. He had a vision of soldiers falling into an Indian camp, meaning that if the Indians followed them, or the soldiers followed them and didn't leave them alone, they would all be killed. And there are still hieroglyphics of that, because the Indians painted that scene, the Deer Medicine Rocks over by the Rosebud. But as to Sitting Bull meeting Reno as Reno's getting ready for the charge, I've never heard that. I've never heard, and I think something like that would maybe have been mentioned at the Court of Inquiry. So Sitting Bull left a warning. What I'm getting at is you have a point there. He left a warning, leave us alone, or this is what's going to happen to you.
Well, it says here, on the morning of June 25th, many of the Lakota gathered in Sitting Bull's village were hoping for a peaceful resolution to their current difficulties with the Washikus, the white men, the soldiers. Years later, several Indians told the cavalryman Hugh Scott that, quote, if Custer had come close and asked for a council instead of attack, he could have led them all into the agency without a fight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I see. All right. Yeah, that's true. That's very true. I've heard that before, that if Custer hadn't come down with an attitude, it may have been a lot different. Okay. Yeah, that's true. One more comment okay. We'll go two more and then we're done.
Okay. I was just wondering why he didn't bring a Gatling gun with him. I mean, he knew he was going to go in. How easy.
He thought it would slow him down. I don't think his men had any sabers, any swords. DeRudio might have, who was with Reno. But they didn't have any of their sabers. And he didn't take his band. He had a regimental band. And you've seen probably some depictions in motion pictures like Little Big Man, how they'd be outside the battle playing the Gary Owen, the great Irish drinking song. And he didn't take the band. The band stayed way back up on the Powder River. So the boys in the band didn't get to go, and that, I think by that time they were probably glad that they had taken up music when they found out what happened to the boss. So, but yeah, in answer to your question, my understanding is the Gatling gun would slow him down. And with all the books written about the battle and the campaign, to me it's always interesting the Native American standpoint on all this.
Murray Sandoz did an early biography of Crazy Horse. Printed in the 1940s, I think.
And there's another one that just came out, Killing Crazy Horse. I haven't read it, but it's supposed to be good. It's supposed to be really good. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming today.